Hi, I'm WTOP Entertainment Editor Jason Fraley, and we are here with
Eric Nelson,
director, and
Catherine Weiler,
producer on The Cold Blue, a new documentary about the Memphis Belle and that whole awesome movie that your father made, actually. It's now playing at AFI Docs. And when's it playing again? It's Saturday? It's,
Saturday at 3 o'clock, like Brigadoon, a one-time screening until the fall when it comes out officially.
Nice. Do you know what venue?
It's at the McGowan Theater, National Archives, 7th in Pennsylvania. $10 a ticket. Be there.
Awesome. Okay, cool. So in order to appreciate The Cold Blue, at least in this for interview purposes, let's start off, Catherine, by setting up, remind our listeners who might not have ever seen The Memphis Belle, what your father, the Hollywood legend William Wyler, so many great movies, just remind him what that was.
The Memphis Belle was a film, a documentary that he made in 1943. It was the story of the 25th mission of a B-17. And at the time that he filmed it, all those guys flying in B-17s were statistically dead on their 16th mission. Wow. So for the first time, the Air Force said, if you could get out of combat if you could survive 25 missions, you could get out of combat if you wanted to, even though you weren't wounded. And this was the first plane to do that. And so this is the story of the 25th mission.
Wow. By 25, you're statistically dead a couple times over, or one and a half times over by that point.
True. And William Wyler, in order to film this, went up on bombing missions with three cameramen, risking his life. And one of the cameramen died in the making of the film. Yeah. He brought back 15 hours of footage, cut a 43-minute classic American documentary out of it, and the remaining 14 and a half hours of footage has been sitting in the National Archives for 75 years until I got a hold of it.
Yeah, so how did you actually think to do that? Because obviously a lot of us have seen and loved Memphis Belle. It's one of the great docs in movie history. But when did you yourself get on board as directing?
Well, my partner, Paul Allen, Microsoft billionaire Paul Allen. Paul Allen has a passion for World War II aviation, and he doesn't just restore airplanes, he restores them and gets them to fly again. It's sort of unprecedented. So the metaphor for me was to restore the footage and get it to fly again by creating a new film that's a feature film that uses some material that was in the Memphis Belle, but mostly material that wasn't in the Memphis Belle in widescreen splendor with a recreated soundtrack because they didn't have microphones up there by the sound designer, the Black Panther. So it's an immersive time machine to the front lines in the most harrowing period of World War II.
That's awesome.
And I'm so thrilled that this brings my father's footage that he risked his life for back onto a big screen today to show people today what it was like to fly in those planes.
Absolutely.
And because of the restoration, you know, one of the things, if you know World War II or old movies, it's in a 3:4 ratio, an old TV set ratio.
Yeah. But because a little more squarish.
This is widescreen and without any loss in quality because of the restoration process and the way we did it. It's widescreen in sharp clarity and in incredible color. It hasn't looked this good since the lab in England in 1943 when it came out of the cameras.
Wow. So you went back to those original negatives.
Went back to
negatives,
the original prints, of the film.
Wow. And so, yeah. So even if you are a fan of Memphis Belle, I mean, let's see it in widescreen. This is going to be great.
But we also restored the Memphis Belle, her dad's film, which had fallen into great disrepair. Her prints had faded, and it was such a fraught production process that some of the film had been damaged in that lab in London, and a lot of things had kind of had gone askew in over the last 75 years. So we recut that film using the raw footage. So we didn't just restore it, we reconstructed it over the existing soundtrack. So the Memphis Belle, the classic documentary, has never looked better, ever.
And that's absolutely true. It's not changed at all. But the change is that it's clean, and the fact that it's in 4K digital now has brought out detail that you could never see before. My father would be so thrilled.
I'm sure he would be, and you've mentioned
as am I.
Yeah, absolutely. You've mentioned it several times. Just that that your father risked his life to do it, as well as, I mean, there was that great docuseries, Five Came Back. It wasn't just your father. It was Frank Capra, George Stevens, John Huston.
John Ford.
And William Wyler.
Wow.
And William Wyler lost his hearing permanently.
Yeah.
Permanently, not during the production of The Memphis Belle, but the next year when he flew a B-25 and you know, it permanently lost his hearing.
The other documentary he made called Thunderbolt. Yeah. You need to restore that next.
Yeah, I know. It's on my to-do list. But Steven Spielberg said in Five Came Back about the Memphis Belle, it's one of the most stunning things I've ever seen.
Yeah.
And Spielberg saw the old degraded prints. Mm-hmm. So we've given him a copy, and I think he's going to be quite impressed when he sees. It's like cleaning a filthy window. It was brown. It just degraded. And now all the color's restored. You're seeing things. We found one shot of a flak damaged nose of a B-17 that was in the Memphis Belle. Mm-hmm. But when we did the restoration, we realized what the cameraman really was shooting was the entire interior of the plexiglass nose was sprayed with blood. The flak shell had vaporized the bombardier. And you didn't see that in the Memphis Belle, but you see it now. And it's something that I'm sure they wouldn't have allowed past the censors in World War II. So again, in some ways, you're seeing the Memphis Belle the way Catherine's father really intended it, in much better quality, because there were camera, there was dirt on the film. They had these little 16mm cameras, and the footage got scratched in London. There were these blue scratches through everything, and they couldn't reshoot. They couldn't go back on bombing missions. So those scratches have been a part of the Memphis Belle forever, and they've been digitally removed now.
That's why you called it the cold blue. It's in honor of the blue scratches,
film.
Right?
No. Yeah, but both projects feed. One is a impressionistic art film about combat and what that was like, and the other is an absolutely scrupulous restoration of the original 1943 film. And they both exist in their own universe, and it's going to be very hard to achieve the stature of such a perfect piece of work as the Memphis Belle, but it's worth the effort.
Wow. You mentioned that... physically, you know, the hearing loss during that mission, but also I almost internally, I noticed a drastic change in the films that those directors put out after coming back. You know, like George Stevens comes back and has that great scene in Giant when Angel Abergon is you know, killed in action. Or your dad, I mean, he's making Wuthering Heights before the war, and then we start seeing Mrs. Miniver during, and then, man, Best Years of Our Lives afterwards. Talk about how you think his whole mindset was even changed in the films he made after, and this experience enabled him to make a Best Years.
Well, sure, there's no question that the war had a huge effect on him and on his later work. Certainly, he always said, as far as Best Years was concerned, that it was one film he didn't have to do any research for, because he knew what it was like to come back from the war and to come back damaged after the war. And I think also that the experience of the war, which he could have easily... he had to really fight to get into the Air Force because he was 40 and he had two children. So
he could have easily dodged it and got out of it.
That's right. So he tried hard to get in. In fact, he finally found a general who he convinced would be really smart to have a guy with a camera following him around. That's how he got in. But I think that the experience made him rather pacifist. And films like Friendly Persuasion and The Big Country, talking about the futility of violence, those definitely came out of his war experiences.
Wow. Wow. And so, remind me, I have just one more question about your dad, then we'll bring it back around. Do you have formative memories, you know, growing up as he's making, you know, Roman Holiday and Ben-Hur and Funny Girl? I mean, are you how conscious
in Roman Holiday?
Are you really?
Yes.
If you know just where to look when Audrey
it's like
goes,
the fountain or something.
That's right.
Yes.
Audrey goes
Explain
in to
it.
Get her haircut, and Greg Peck doesn't have a camera, and Eddie Albert isn't there. There's a little group of schoolgirls. My sister gets the close-up as he tries to take the camera, and I'm in the rear calling the teacher. Hey, I had three deathless words. Hey, Miss Weber.
Wow.
That's the last of my screen attempts.
They didn't put you in any of the other ones? You weren't in the chariot race or anything? What do you remember from him during his Ben-Hur time?
You were in Italy there for a year, weren't you?
I was only there because I was in school, so I was only there in the summer.
Okay.
But I remember that he was having a very fine time. When he took that job, it was because he was so excited about the chariot race. Then when the producer, Sam Zimbalist, told him, no, you don't have time for that. That's a second unit. Oh, he was very disappointed.
He did it that we wanted to do the project for the chariot race. Something I didn't know that, you did is he's the guy who cast and developed Sound of Music. He put Julie Andrews in the Sound of Music.
Before Robert Wise took over?
And Wise took it over. That was one of those projects he could have had and developed it and gave it the zap it needed.
Do you know why he passed on it?
I do, because my mother said it was keeping him up at night, and he finally said he just couldn't make a movie about those nice Nazis.
We're back to the effect of it.
We're back to the effect of it.
That's right.
No, that's absolutely true. Well, he got another chance at a musical with Streisand.
Funny Girl.
Right. And Funny Girl. Memories of
him. And they
of
worked
your dad.
Together great, too.
Yep.
They both, he could handle Betty Davis and Barbara Streisand.
I mean, come on.
And Catherine as a rebellious teenager.
That was the hardest one of all.
But I remember going on the set of Funny Girl and seeing my father and Barbara holding hands. And in fact, there was a lot of press at the time about how difficult and what a hard time they were having, which is totally untrue.
And your eyes are telling you different. You're like, these guys, they're getting along.
He was definitely a father figure for her.
Aw. And Omar as well, Sharif?
Well,
different story?
That was a different story.
What do you mean?
He didn't have any trouble with Omar.
Right.
But. That wasn't,
I worked with Omar Sharif.
Did you?
I have to tell you my Omar Sharif story. Yeah, I actually did it. So there's the 1 degree of separation
there.
There
you go.
And that's the last.
Go for it, man. We're talking movies. We can go.
No, I did a terrible, wrote a terrible live, the Pyramids live from London. Remember the great Geraldo in the vault live scare?
Yeah.
Well, this was a follow-up, and Omar Sharif was the host.
Oh, wow.
In his tuxedo, and we filmed actually at this place that was this amazing estate. And a couple of years ago, I was watching Downton Abbey. And I said, oh my God, that's where we were. We spent a week at Downton Abbey in that library filming. Yeah. But I remember Omar was totally soul of perfection until about 10 minutes before we rolled live. And he had a complete, utter meltdown.
Oh, no.
Shrieking at the director, just absolutely lost his S word.
Oh my God.
And then the red light went on and he hit every mark and could not have been more professional. But it just kind of got to him after a while.
He needed Fanny Bryce to keep him in line.
It was all due to
the
ramshackle production, I'm sure. But when he was cool, and then when we're rolling, he's just having a cigarette between takes. Millions of people are watching this. It was not unlike Peter O'Toole in My Favorite Year when he realized, you mean live?
People,
I'm just speaking?
He had that, nice pull.
He had that Peter O'Toole moment. So that's my Omar Sharif story.
Wow.
That reminds me that I just saw the new Gilda Radner doc. When it was live, boy, she was on. It's a wonderful documentary.
That's their comfort zone almost. They see the light go on, and then whatever meltdown was happening, they just settle in, I guess.
Well, they're pros.
They're pros.
That's a kind of a – and it's old school Hollywood that William Wyler certainly knew. I mean, it's a whole different ecosystem there. And, with the Cold Blue, was always looking over my shoulders. I'm grappling, making some of the same editing choices. How can I construct a sequence – There was one sequence in
no
my
pressure.
Film. Well, there was one sequence. I didn't watch the Memphis Belle for a year prior and during my film. I just didn't
want
it in my
head. You didn't want,
I wanted to watch. Part of the fun was to take footage that was shot by cinematographers, but with a modern day eye to what's significant. To me, seeing a contrail, a single take of a contrail for 30 seconds with 50 airplanes, let me see it for 30 seconds. I don't need to cut.
Right.
But when we did the takeoff sequence, I was looking at all this dog's breakfast of planes and different – I just could not figure out how to make it work. So I finally said, okay, let's go back and watch the Memphis Belle because I can't cut this.
Yeah.
So we went back and it's like, oh, it goes like – it was like, oh, I see. It was that Mozart Soliari moment where you see, oh, that's how it goes together. So unfortunately –
Poor Soliari.
Yeah, poor Soliari. And I'm this definite Soliari in it. But that was the only time when I had to go back to the original But he did pick.
But I think my father would be very happy with the Cold Blue. I mean, that's what he called me out of the blue to tell me he's making this movie using my father's footage. And I thought, well, that's nice that the footage will have a new life. Mm-hmm. But I had no idea it was going to be such a great film as the Cold Blue is.
It was a bit presumptuous to sort of call Catherine Weiler saying, you know, because it's in the public domain, you go ahead, right, you have at it. You know, anyone.
Yeah, but I'm glad you did. That's a nice touch.
There's a difference between could do something and should do something.
Right.
And I've learned that, and since then, you know, Catherine, from the moment, you know, when we started talking about the restoration of the Memphis Belle, mm-hmm. they had to be done together because it has to be a level playing field. It wouldn't have been fair for me to restore, quote, my movie and then have these degraded copies of the Memphis Belle where people would say wouldn't watch it just because it didn't look good.
Yeah.
So now both films exist, and if people want to compare the two or say, Christ, why would anyone remake a perfect film? What was this presumptuous director doing now? Fine with me. It's a level playing field.
Yeah, absolutely. Talk about, you mentioned the Hollywood, and they were pros. That's the old Hollywood. But it's also an old, the greatest generation idea of these famous people. I mean, even the actors, Jimmy Stewart would be doing bomber missions.
Yeah, he flew.
I mean, now it's like less than 1% of the country goes and fights, and you definitely wouldn't see these celebrities go off. I can't imagine the big Hollywood star.
If we had the right, if we had an enemy as durable as the Nazis in a different time, even in today's fractured culture, it's hard to imagine an enemy as
like a total war kind of
a
deal,
total war and in an attack. But it just was a different time. There was a time, you know, I think the United States, it's going to be a while, but we'll hopefully kind of reconvene as a nation soon and take stock of everything.
I hope so. But I guess what I'm getting at is not so much whether we would do it today, but just talk about those five came back guys and how courageous that was that they went. And like you're saying, like your dad didn't have to go. He could have easily just
Reagan and John Wayne didn't. They set out the war at Fort Hal Roach.
Right.
Neither of them did.
Right.
Weiler, but those guys. Yeah. And Capra said he didn't go overseas, not because he wasn't courageous.
Right.
But it was no one was more upfront than William Wyler, because when he was flying, it was a 1 in 4 chance, you know, you'd go down.
Wow.
So
that's crazy.
Houston and Ford and Stevens, no offense, weren't in the middle of it. This guy, against the regs, got in a plane and flew 5 bomber missions. Cronkite flew 1.
Wow. And think of all the great movies we would have lost.
Absolutely. Well, my mother said that it was really part of it was just his character that he, you know, this was the big thing that was going on and he didn't want to miss it. Plus the fact that he, you know, was born and raised in Europe and was Jewish and, he wanted to be part of it.
If he'd been shot down and survived, a Oscar-winning Jewish director, what would have happened to Weiler, who was also not legitimately, they could argue, not really in uniform, even though he had a commission.
Oh, my God. So, I don't even want to think about it.
And we interviewed 9 guys in our movie, all of whom B-17s. Of the 9 guys, 5 of them were shot down. 5 of them. Whew. One of them was shot down on his very first mission. And he got back and flew 23 more missions.
Hmm.
So the odds, and this was in 44, 45, where the odds were much better. 43, it was more guys died in the 8th Air Force than died in the U.S. Marines in World War II.
Yeah. Isn't that astounding?
It's crazy to think.
And the thing,
don't realize it.
And the point we try to make in our film is these guys were flying in unpressurized airplanes that got down to 60 below zero at altitudes equivalent to Mount Everest. And they were in those altitudes for 3 to 4 hours. So imagine standing at the summit of Mount Everest for 3 to 4 hours and doing it 22 times to 35 times over the course of 3 or 4 months. With 40,000 German 88-millimeter guns firing shells 6 miles straight up that could do pinpoint. And if you're shot down, the odds of you being captured by – you were lucky if you were captured by the German army. If you were unfortunate and landed with the civilians, they'd pitchfork you to death, as one veteran tells us in our film. You kind of forget – that's a level of
stakes, man.
And you're 19 years old, and your pilot is 23 years old, and you've got 10 swinging dicks in the plane who've trained together. Who, you know, it's a crucible that you cannot conceive of.
Yeah, That's unbelievable. After that whole experience, did your father stay close and in touch with the five came back guys? Did they have a bond going forward?
I'm not sure they had a bond because of that.
Right.
You know, he was,
I guess because a lot of people went and fought. Yeah.
He was friends with some and not with others. I don't think that.
He was in Liberty Films with Capra and Stevens, her business partners.
Right? That's right.
They founded it right away. Right. And it didn't last very long. Right?
Best Years of Our Lives and It's a Wonderful Life were Answer Records.
Yeah.
Once a Wonderful Life was scratching that same kind of America,
absolutely,
reconnecting with itself, and so was the Best Years of Our Lives.
Speaking of which, was Capra giving George Bailey the hearing loss? Was that a nod to your dad, you think? Remember how he loses his hearing in one ear, George Bailey? I'm curious if that was inspired by the hearing loss. I don't know. I'm just riffing, but who knows?
That's really interesting.
Who knows?
I hadn't thought about it.
Never thought about it.
Yeah.
But anyway, we can't thank those guys, and especially your dad. I mean, like you're saying, I mean, he really put himself out there unlike any of those.
Well, he brought
other
back the goods, you know, and the thing that I've always imagined in being able to work with Catherine is what he would have thought of my film, because he never saw it like this.
Right.
You know, at one point, Catherine and I had a friendly argument. I wanted to take the Memphis Belle and put it in 16:9 widescreen. And Catherine said, no, it's going to stay in the aspect ratio because that's the way it was.
Right.
I still don't think you're right.
And I still know I'm right.
Yeah, because
we're not going to solve it in this room, guys.
But I argued saying that what would your dad think? You know, reaching the mass audience, he would want it on the best available delivery system. Yeah. But the good news, it doesn't matter because the Cold Blue is in 16:9. And he recorded sound after the fact in Los Angeles and overdubbed it. So did I. My guy came off the Black Panther, and we brought a Lucasfilm Skywalker sound team to do it.
You might have heard of those movies.
Weiler worked with the best guys in Hollywood, and when I listened to the Memphis Belle, I'm thinking, you know, dude, you got it handled. There's no flies on that movie on any technical level, let alone the way, except the footage doesn't look very good, and it never looked very good because it went from negative to 16mm, then was blown up to 35.
Yeah.
The moment the film was released, it started to deteriorate.
Yeah.
And thank God in the National Archives, somebody just put the work reels in a box in, you know, the end of Raiders of the Lost Ark storage area.
And it top was, men.
Yeah.
Put it away.
Put it away. And it just was hiding in plain sight. It wasn't discovered. It was always there in their card catalog. Yeah. It just nobody thought to think, you know, we had to just do something with that.
It should be in a museum.
Well, or do something, you know, come up with a way that honors everybody, including William Wyler and the 28,000 men of the 8th Air Force who died, so we can have this conversation today, not in German.
Yeah, honestly. It's a great point. What's next? Obviously, it's playing Saturday at AFI Docs.
That's the first
tell
test.
Me about your, is there going to be a wider release?
Yes.
If our listeners can't, if some reason they're busy this weekend or out of town.
It's going to be out there. It's going to have its way in the culture. It's going to come out theatrically in the fall. It's going to then be on, you know, and out in Streamingville, watch it on TV Land next summer in time for the 75th anniversary of D-Day.
Mm.
It'll be in the culture. It'll be out on Blu-ray. You know, these
but
have a long
sure,
tail.
The next local screening may be Veterans Day at either the Silver Theater or the National Archives. I'm not sure.
Oh, cool.
Which time they're going to play both films.
Oh, awesome.
And maybe a third. We're now thinking, we just had the idea today of a triple bill, which is the Memphis Belle, the Cold Blue, and Best Year of Our Lives.
Honestly, can you please do it? Honestly, I mean, yes, it's held up as a classic, but I still think it's even underrated amongst the classics in that upper echelon. I think Best Years of Our Lives and Anne Hornaday of the Washington Post, we always talk about this. That's her cause. We're trying to get that up there with, you know, the best of the best.
We just finished our speaking with Anne Hornaday before we came to
see
you.
Did she say the same thing?
She signed up. She said, I'm your, you know, so now you've got to. You can do the warm-up act.
I'm there with you guys. Yeah. Right. No, I mean, it's a worthy cause. Honestly, I think The Best Years of Our Lives is one of the greatest movies ever made. So,
well, I, of course, grossly and modestly think now we have a trilogy here. You know, we've got The Memphis Belle, which is now restored and on its legs. We have The Cold Blue, which sort of shows forensically what Wyler was doing up there and really showcases his material. And then you have this utter masterpiece, Best Year of Our Lives, that deals with the consequences. So there is now a official trilogy. And even if it was Memphis Belle, leave my film out of it. Best Year of Our Lives. That's one hell of a double bill.
I say we do it. Either the double or a trifecta for Veterans Day. Sure. I want my like younger generations to sit and watch. They would be kept. They'd be like, "What's best years of our lives, dude?" When they sit and see it, they are going to be blown away.
It was on some 10 best lists when people were coming home from Iraq.
Oh, yeah.
You know, it really
ahead of its time. Look, Iraq veterans are relating to this movie that was made in 46. How crazy is that?
Right. Well,
exactly. Way ahead of its time talking about. I mean, yeah, we got it with the coming homes and Born on 4th of July's and Deer Hunters like decades after. But your dad was doing this right after World War II. That's insane.
And that's not in, 2 hours and 40 minutes? And he races it into theaters to qualify for the Oscars. And he's thinking, really?
Yeah.
No one's going to want to see this thing.
And it beats It's a Wonderful Life.
I think it's Goldwyn who said, Goldwyn who was like, no, you know, put it out.
Yeah.
You know, they kind of had a hunch. It had a, he just made it. And that last scene, you know, in that flashback sequence, you know, when they just improvised that scene.
Yeah.
They didn't have it solved. They didn't know, how do I end it? How do we finish off this guy's story? So they go to the graveyard, and that's where they sort of said, okay. And they started filming it, and then he had the idea of dubbing in the audio, probably because of the Memphis Belle. He was aware of, you know, he knew what he could do orally.
Sure.
And he sort of improvises the ending of the film.
Wow.
Yeah, it's just Darby Giants.
And they were right to rush it out because it won. It beat Capra's Wonderful Life. Do you have a favorite scene in that? To me, it's when Frederick March comes home and the wife just stiffens up and you see her from behind.
And that is my favorite scene. And my father talks about it in the documentary that I made about him, which I'll get for you if you haven't seen
it. I would love to.
He said that, or maybe it was my mother who talked about it, that she went to New York to meet him at some point during the war when she hadn't seen him for quite a long time. And she was in a hotel room, and she opened the door, and he was just getting off the elevator, so they had to run to each other in down the corridor, and he recreated that scene
with a little assist from Greg Toland,
of course,
the great.
That's right.
Yeah, to me, it's any scene with Harold Russell in it.
Oh yeah, of course.
That's my, you know, where do you go?
He won for it too, I believe. Yeah,
he did.
And then you have the Dan Andrews stuff with the plane and the flashbacks.
But
and
again, the genius of William Wyler, Dad.
Teresa Wright.
You know, he sees Harold Russell in a film on disabled veterans who doesn't even have much of a speaking role. He just sees the guy.
Yeah.
And maybe a silent movie training said, there, him, and brings him in and said from Ditko, once he met him, you're the guy. He'd never acted before. And had trouble. I mean, he wasn't. Your dad could be a tad of.
Tad I'm sure he was
persistent on
That's
the
right.
set, but he got
he
the performance
easy.
He needed out of him. And,
wow!
And the
and
rest
I believe
is
that he
history.
Got not only the Oscar for Best Supporting Actor, but the Academy didn't expect him to get anything, so they gave him a special Oscar.
Yeah, I think
so
he's the only person to ever win two in the same night. That's one of those trivia facts. Yeah, is that your favorite film of your father's, or is there another one that
you know? It's funny. My favorite film used to be Wuthering Heights because that's the character I was named after.
Really? Okay.
Yes, and I've managed not to come to such a bad end. But anyway.
He's naming you Jezebel, but anyway.
I could have named that.
So, no, I think that Best Years is absolutely his masterpiece.
I mean, I think everyone would agree, right? It's so great. Awesome. Well, I mean, I could sit and talk this stuff with you guys
all
day.
We'll save it for our Veterans Day celebration where you and... UNN Hornaday can iron cage duke it out for the moderator spot. Actually, though, if it turns out to be a three-part thing, it'd be great. Both of you'd be fabulous because who has the stamina to do all of that?
Well, Anne is in another league. I love her to death. But yes, I'm there. I'm all there to promote it. And it's one of those. I tell everyone because for some reason everyone watches This Wonderful Life on Thanksgiving, Christmas, but for some reason a lot of people my age haven't seen Best Years, and I'm like, dude, you have to watch this.
Well, it connects you to an experience that, you know, Wonderful Life is, you know, when they made Back to the Future, Spielberg showed that movie to the cast saying, this is the movie we're making.
Right.
So there's this sort of relevance, you know, it shows what you want to think the world is like, whereas Best Year of your Lives shows the way the world really is.
Yeah.
So what do you think is going to be the Thanksgiving holiday? You know, it's a tougher truth.
Right.
So again, why it's ahead of itself.
Absolutely. Thanks so much for coming in. This is great. This is great. Catherine Weiler, Eric Nelson. Again, it's called The Cold Blue at AFI Docs. And stay tuned for Veterans Day. Thanks so much for coming in, guys.
Thank you.